We are pleased to have Lois Melchett speak to us about healing their society. Her talk will be about how the privileged lived and worked among the poor in British and American cities. Well-educated, prosperous, middle-class young men and women moved to immigrant neighborhoods, pioneering the settlement house movement as a means of breaking down class, ethnic, and religious barriers in the late 19th century and early 20th century. Lois received a BA from Sarah Lawrence College, an MA from Renaissance and Reformation History from Columbia University, and a PhD in English and American History from the University of Sussex in England. Before she retired in 2010, she taught full-time at the college level for close to 40 years. Most recently, she taught at Fullerton College, and that was since 1991. She has various publications and loves teaching and writing about middle class and social and religious reform. She is a longtime member of UCF and is currently a member of the board. Lois.
Thank you, Dale. It's a pleasure to be here and to have this opportunity to talk about something that means a great deal to me. Over the last several months, when we've had testimonials here, I've really felt like I belong, and I could really identify with the people who talked about how they wanted a community that was undogmatic, where they had an opportunity to believe what they believed and still work together, who have a sense of social justice. So I found these testimonials very moving, and I count myself happily among you. I have spent much of my life trying to help those who were less privileged than I am, who are not as well-educated or who did not have the same advantages that I do. And I know that I'm in good company here because many of you feel the same way and have done the same thing. And as I look at this banner, we do not need to think alike, to love alike. And I believe Wesley did that. It so beautifully reflects how we think and feel and do. One of the things that I love about history and that I love about teaching history and talking about it is that everything has a history. And so in my classes over the years, I've had students who were planning to go into nursing or engineering or social work or whatever. And I always try to get them to look at the history of what it is that they're interested in. And one of my great joys is being able to talk about a history that I have looked into, and it has to do with people of education and privilege who put their lives on the line to help others and to heal their society. So that is what I'm going to be talking about with pleasure today. The Settlement House Movement is a movement that started in London really in the 1870s, although the first settlement house was actually in the mid-1880s. It was a movement, a voluntary movement, of young, well-educated, first it was men, then it became men and women, who went and lived in the slums. That's the best way to characterize those neighborhoods. They were overcrowded. They were filled with people who didn't have the means to have decent housing at that time. And they were people who did not have access to a very good education. So these young people who came from privileged backgrounds and who were themselves very well educated and had lots of choices of what to do with their lives, decided that they would go and spend time. Some of them spent their whole lives doing this. Others spent a few years doing it. They did this voluntarily, and they went to live and work among the poor, most of whom were immigrants. So that's what the Settlement House movement is about. It's about young people who actually took up residence in the city slums. I have a couple of personal connections to this movement. One is that my mother, who grew up on the Lower East Side of New York, went to the Henry Street Settlement House. And there she took violin lessons, and they lent her a violin. And she told me about that when I was very little. Also, my father's sister, my Aunt Helen, lived in a high-rise on the Lower East Side of New York, and lived to be 93. And I remember that Will and I and our children went to visit her in the 1990s when she was about 93 years old. And she still painted. She still had her little easel, and she was still painting. And the Educational Alliance, which is a descendant of the Settlement House movement, saw to it that she got an exhibit at a little community center near her house. And we had the privilege of going there and congratulating her and seeing her work. So from my mother being a little girl going to the Henry Street Settlement and my aunt being a very elderly woman with the Educational Alliance, my family personally has benefited from this. My grandparents were all immigrants. They were from Russia, sometimes Poland, sometimes it was Russia, Jewish immigrants, and they came with nothing, and they were able to be successful. It was somewhat through their own efforts, of course, but it was the help that they got from other people. I studied this topic for many years, and I'm going to share a few of my thoughts about it with you. The Settlement House movement really started with the Anglican Church in London. Of course, now all eyes are on London because of the Olympics, and there have been occasions when we've thought about London as being a glamorous place and a place of excitement. I remember from my teenage years, of course, and they still live on in many ways, the Beatles. Of course, they weren't from London, but they wound up there a lot of the time. The fact is that except for some of those key moments, and I guess here I would have to include the antics of the royal family, which have attracted a lot of attention, much of it negative, but for much of its history, England seems to most of us to be very stable, very solid, very staid, even boring. And yet, if we look at its history, it's had a few exciting and even rather dangerous moments. For instance, when Charles I was beheaded in 1649, and you can actually go to the Parliament building in London and see the place where he was beheaded, that was pretty exciting for a lot of people, probably for Charles, too. anyway... that happened over 100 years, 140 years before the French started to do this sort of thing. You had civil wars, you had religious wars in England, and it left its mark. And one of the consequences of this is that the established Church of England, the Anglican Church, decided that it was going to be what we call a comprehensive church. That is a church that welcomed various beliefs and didn't emphasize belief all that much, was rather undogmatic about belief, but said that as long as you come to church, as long as you accept the church, that you would be a British, or first English and then a British subject. And they were forced to do this because of the religious wars that had preceded and accompanied its early history. Charles I's father, James I, I'm sure you all know him, even though you may not realize it, because he was the one who authorized the committee of 50 scholars to translate the Bible that became the King James Version of the Bible. And on that committee of 50, there were people of all, they were all Christian, it's true, but various Christian persuasions, all the way from Catholic on the one hand to a kind of radical Puritanism on the other. And they were all there as part of the committee contributing to this translation. Now, the person who started the Settlement House movement, his name was Canon Barnett, and for a long time we'll refer to him as the other man in my life, because I did my doctoral dissertation on him, and for years I devoted myself to him. So anyway, that was a long time ago. I think Will's forgiven him for that. but in any case, Canon Barnett, he became a canon eventually, but he was a vicar at St. Jude's Parish in London. St. Jude's Parish was in the East End of London. If any of you have visited London recently and are interested in art, you may have gone over to the Whitechapel Gallery, which is there now. At the time that Barnett was sent to St. Jude's, that was 1873, it was very poor, and it was filled with immigrants. Something like 30% of the population of his parish were Jewish, and they were from the same place as my grandparents, Eastern Poland, Western Russia, that whole area. And about 35% of them were Irish Catholic. Now, the thing about the Anglican Church is that it is the national church of England, and today of Britain, and it is supposed to minister to all the people, and that's why it has this kind of non-doctrinal approach. But it's divided into parishes, and if you live in a parish, that church is supposed to be for you. The church had a rural basis at first, and the model for it was really the village church, where you had all classes of people come together and they could all worship together. So the idea of the church is the nation at prayer. So when Barnett asked for and received this urban living, he had his hands full. What does he do as a Christian to make the church, a term we would use today, he probably wouldn't have used it, relevant to all the people in your parish, most of whom, as I say, are poor, are immigrants, are either Catholic or Jewish. So he improvised for a period of over a decade, improvised ways of reaching these people. He went out in disguise, and he tried to find out, what are these people like? What do they need? What do they want? And he tried first by himself, and then he got help in providing it. At first, he would take the children of the parish to various parks in London. He would take them to museums. He would take them to attractive country spots to give them opportunities that they would not otherwise have had. He tried to improve the parish schools. He was friendly with William Morris. He asked Morris to please come and redecorate the church. He darkened the side aisles so people wouldn't be ashamed to come in even if they were not well-dressed. He organized concerts, art shows, working men's clubs, got involved in the distribution of charity. So he tried to do all these things pretty much by himself, but first of all, the church wasn't really that thrilled with it because this was sort of going out of bounds. For instance, he would have concerts on Sunday. Well, you weren't supposed to do that, and various things. There were other people in the church who believed in what he was doing, but it was not by any means unanimous. In any case, he got young men that he knew from Oxford and Cambridge. Samuel Barnett was a graduate of Oxford, of Wadham College, and he had a lot of connections there. And he got young men to come and live at the church during their vacations so that they could help him out with the parish machinery and have this outreach to the neighborhood. Well, eventually, that became formalized with the founding of the Settlement House. That was in 1884, and that was Toynbee Hall. And by the way, although Toynbee Hall was bombed in World War I, it now stands proudly today. It's been redone, and it's a very large institution in the heart of Whitechapel in East London. Now, these young, and they were men, they participated in all these different events that Barnett had pioneered, and they improved on them. Instead of just taking children on day excursions to the country, they formed a camp that they could spend a week or 2 weeks at in the summertime. They built an art gallery. They gave lectures on the areas that they were knowledgeable about, and they invited their friends to come, some of whom were rather prominent. For instance, James Bryce. Some of you may have heard of him. Bryce became the ambassador to the U.S. At that time. They had flower shows. They even had a contest for the people of the neighborhood or parish to vote on the painting they liked the best of the ones that they saw. So these were all various things that they did. They got involved in making the distribution of charity more personal and fairer than it had been. So Toynbee Hall became the first settlement house. Now, there were then others that imitated Toynbee Hall in different parts of England, and it was a stretch because, as I said before, the church that they had in their mind through their history was a village church in the country. But now they're living in the city, and the city has these tremendous class divisions, divisions between rich and poor. Those of you who've read Dickens are acquainted with the terrible conditions and the filth of industrial cities in London, in England, including Manchester and Birmingham, and to some extent in London as well. Now, a lot of Americans who were able to do so wanted to go to London and to these other cities to find out what was going on. And so there were many Americans who went there, and one of them was Jane Addams. And she went and she visited with Barnett, and she found out about his parish machinery and about his plans for Toynbee Hall, and then eventually went back and viewed Toynbee Hall a little bit later. And she was one of many Americans who then came back and started settlement houses in American cities. And American cities were going through much of the same problems that were plaguing England. That is, sharp class divisions, although we didn't call them class, and we still really don't call them class, but everybody's in the middle class. We just have upper middle class and lower middle class. You know how that goes. But in any case, we did have, and sadly still do, had sharp divisions. This was the Gilded Age. There were tremendous amounts of wealth that were really held by relatively few people. Some people had more money than they knew what to do with. Some people had nothing. So these young Americans were interested in seeing what they could do to, in some ways, follow the British model, but to adapt it to American conditions. So the settlement house movement really spread into American cities. In fact, there was at least one in L.A. There were a number in New York, in Chicago, in Philadelphia, Boston, New Orleans. By 1900, there were some 100 settlement houses. By 1905, there were some 200 settlement houses. By 1910, there were some 400 settlement houses in the United States. And they all shared the same characteristics in that they attracted young, educated men, and now in the American one, mostly were women. And they went voluntarily, and they worked for nothing, and they volunteered their time and efforts to improve, as they thought, the best that they could to improve those neighborhoods. There's a story about one of the first settlements in New York, the College Settlement House on the Lower East Side. There were seven young women who went there, and they bought a house, or maybe they rented a house in order to do their work. And the first callers they had at the house were the police. And the police thought they were opening up a brothel. Like, what else would they be doing there, you know? And assured them that they wouldn't prosecute them if they paid them off. And the headline in the paper was, Seven Lilies Planted in the Mud. So anyway, and of course there was Lillian Wald who started Henry Street. But Jane Addams was in Chicago, and she started probably the best known of all, Hull House. And I happened to have had the pleasure a number of years ago to meet a man, he was quite elderly at the time, who knew Jane Addams because he lived in Chicago. And he said he remembers her, he remembers going to Hull House and seeing her down on her hands and knees washing the floor. That was the kind of woman that she was. She was, of course, like most of them, she was a college graduate. She'd been to Rockford Seminary in Illinois, which was a young college. The early women's colleges were called seminaries. Many of them trained women to be missionaries, although that was not something that appealed to her. And she came from a family that had, it was a farm family, but it was prosperous. Her father knew Abraham Lincoln. They were, of course, both from Illinois. It was a small place. And so she had lots of other opportunities. For a while, she thought she'd be a physician, but that didn't work out. And she came back to Chicago to pioneer the work that she had seen in London with Samuel Barnett. And while we do not have established churches, while we don't have the same self-conscious class divisions, the fact is that it translated rather well. There were certain changes that Addams made from what Barnett had done, but the basic idea of volunteers coming and giving their time, in many cases, as with Jane Addams, giving her life for this, was what they carried on. We, too, had many immigrants. Most of them were not the old pattern from Northern and Western Europe. Most of them were not Protestants at this point. They were Jews. They were Catholics. They were Orthodox, people from Greece, from Russia, who were Orthodox. And they were all in these neighborhoods. So what Addams did with her roommate from Rockford Seminary, Ellen Gates Starr, was they rented a house, which eventually they bought and then redid, and they just came and started with themselves. And then others came. Men came, women came, and they lived with them. Now, the people of the neighborhood did not live at the settlement house. They lived in their own whatever it was, tenements, apartments. But it was like, I guess you could say, a community center is what we would have today, except that these well-educated and prosperous people lived there. And they got involved in everything that you can imagine. They had some of the first kindergartens. These kindergartens were originally for the children of the mothers who were working, and they were working in the stockyards, in the meatpacking houses, in domestic service, in the needle trades, a lot of sweated labor. Conditions in the United States at that time were terrible. Working conditions. Men worked, women worked, whoever could get a job worked. So they had these kindergartens for these young children. They also offered adult education for the older people. They started a visiting nurses service. They worked on protective legislation to protect, in those days it was just women and children, for safety, health measures, maximum hours that they could work, and so on. They saw to it that there were parks and playgrounds that they could make happen in those neighborhoods. They saw to it that services that are often not given to poor people, government services, were started, like, for instance, garbage collection. There's a story about Jane Addams running after the garbage men, saying, wait a minute, you have to start collecting garbage here. And of course, because she had some clout, because of her education and her connections, she was able to get the attention of City Hall. Another thing that she and the other settlers were able to achieve was to get concrete sidewalks in these areas of Chicago. It seems unbelievable to us, although I guess we're working on bringing some of those things back, sadly. Children would drown in the puddles because they had no sidewalks and it was so muddy. And you know how children play and whatever, and some of them drowned. So they wanted decent sidewalks. Also, another aspect of Hull House was to give music lessons like Henry Street did. And Benny Goodman, who was a child of immigrants in Chicago, got his first clarinet lessons at Hull House. Jane Addams personally started a labor museum where the mothers of these young women who were working in the needles trade could see that when they were back home in Italy, that they did their own weaving and their own spinning, and they had all of this in the museum really as a way to heal the generational gaps between these young Americanized women and their mothers who they kind of looked down on for not knowing English and so on. They worked on lots of different things. I'm not going to go into everything, but just to give you a general idea. They did social investigation of the neighborhood to find out how people lived and how they got by and what they needed, and then they would testify before state committees for legislation. These were the early years of the progressive reform, and they were able to provide valuable information. They had a coffee shop at Hull House because in the tenements where these people lived, they didn't have any spare room. They didn't have any place where they could gather, and so they wanted something wholesome where they could go and plan their lives and socialize and whatever. So, as I said before, some devoted their full lives. Some of them became teachers, civil servants, philanthropists of various kinds, but they did work at Hull House or at these other settlements, and they got their experience there. And I take that as an example of what can be done even though we look back at some of their ideas and we look back at some of the things they did and we think, well, you know, why didn't they think about more structural changes in the society? Why didn't they think about perhaps emphasizing, Jane Addams did this, but not all of them did, the indigenous culture of the people who were there instead of trying to create a more Americanized culture. Maybe some people criticize them for being too assimilationist in an era where we tend to be more pluralistic. But the part about it that inspires me and gives me hope is that they were willing to do the best that they could to make the society better as they understood that. And that serves as an important inspiration. Now, there's something that I brought with me, but I forgot to bring it up here, so I'll have, as my husband, I'll use pull here to show you this cookbook. Maybe some of you have one similar. It's called The Settlement Cookbook. It's called the Settlement Cookbook because the very first one was done in 1901 by the Milwaukee Settlement House. And it was done as a way of raising money for the Settlement House, but it was also a way of giving to the people of the neighborhood in Milwaukee an opportunity to learn about American foods that could substitute for foods that they were importing and that they were paying a lot of money for that they didn't have, how to substitute that, our weights and measures, all that sort of thing. And it was so popular that it's been through a gazillion different editions and so forth. But anyway, if you want to look at it, there it is. So that's where I get a lot of my hope for today and my inspiration, because it is for me really depressing looking at the divisions in our own society today and how we seem as a nation so unwilling to really do something about it. Of course, we have our job creators and we have our creed of survival of the fittest, which I guess has lasted from, you know, the 19th century, and it's just because they're not as good as we are, and so they're not as successful as we are. And all this, as I'm sure for many of you, it makes me very sad and rather sick. On the other hand, there are things to be done. And looking at the Settlement House and looking at this congregation and looking at the UUs in general, I do have hope. And I think that if they could do it, we can do it. After all, these settlements were founded in the Gilded Age, when there was the laissez-faire and social Darwinism and all of that. And yet, they made a difference. They made a difference in people's lives in a very personal way. I just want to say that just very recently I had two very moving experiences that also give me hope, very personal. Will mentioned Anna's graduation from basic training. At that graduation, there were 150 young people. They all looked so healthy and strong and proud, and many of them, they're in the military, something that I wouldn't have chosen myself, but they're very idealistic. They want to do something other than just kill people. You know, they want to make the world a better place, and that seems to be a way for them to do that. At that ceremony, there were five people who became citizens, who were from all parts of the world, who were in now the Army. There were 150 graduates, 50 of them were women. That's progress. So maybe things are changing. Then, just by chance, we were house-sitting a couple of weeks ago for friends of ours who live near UCLA, and I'm doing research there at the archives on a project that I'm working on. And so we house-sat for them, and we went to the local Denny's to have breakfast, and these people are coming in, these young people. So I'm trying to figure out, who are these people? Well, I'm thinking they're probably a study group from a class. But no, it got bigger. And there were people of every size, shape, color, you name it, they were there. And they had this sense about them of being good friends, not just they're in the same class, but like they would hug each other and, what are they doing? Who are these people? And then I noticed that one of them was wearing a shirt that said Unicamp. And the Unicamp is the university camp that was actually started by some young people in the 1930s who raised the money themselves. They were students at UCLA. They raised the money themselves, and they became the counselors for the children in the surrounding areas, of course, during the Depression, who didn't have any way of getting out of a city in the summertime. And from 1934 to now, that camp has continued and has thrived. And I thought, you know what? The very first beginnings of a settlement, Samuel Barnett got these London kids to camp. And here in Westwood in 2012, here they are meeting at Denny's on the way to Unicamp to work with kids, underprivileged kids. Well, I guess that's not politically correct, but whatever you want to say, disadvantaged. So it carries on. And anyway, I'm delighted to have this opportunity to talk to you about it. We won't have our regular talk back, but I will be up here if you want to ask any questions or make any comments. I'd be more than happy to talk to you. Thank you so much.